All right, if you're anything like me, you hate running out of food on a trip. It's like a big fear. And so I'm a big fan of snacks during an adventure. And one of my absolute favorite go-to snacks are Wonderful Pistachios. You may be familiar with pistachios and the brand Wonderful Pistachios, but if you're not, they are one of the highest protein nuts out there. 1 ounce serving of Wonderful Pistachios is 6 grams of protein. That's 10% of your daily value. It also includes 9 essential amino acids, and they come with a ton of different flavors, varieties. There's a spicy version, there's lightly salted, there's no salted, there's so many. And every time I go on an adventure, I'm not even lying, I take an entire bag with me. And what's cool too, I love having the Wonderful Pistachio in shell, because then that almost gives me something to do and focus on as I'm paddling or biking through the really monotonous parts of the adventure. Every great adventure is going to have plenty of boring moments, and it's nice to have something to do and also something that is giving you some fuel, like Wonderful Pistachios. So they're one of my favorite adventure snacks, favorite road trip snacks, and definitely leave me feeling better than a lot of other snacks you can turn to. So if you want to learn more about how to fuel your next adventure with Wonderful Pistachios, go to WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more. This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's cowboy boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. So stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and the friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, that's fine. Just go to Tecovas.com. That's Tecovas.com. They offer free shipping on all boots as well as free returns and exchanges. They ship right to your door. Go to Tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today. And get ready for this summer. If you ever thought, can I pull off a pair of cowboy boots? Then you should pull on a pair of Tecovas and you'll see. They'll become your new favorite footwear. Cowboys knew what they were doing when they invented this Western wear.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey folks, welcome to the Adventure Sports Podcast. I'm your host, Mason. You're going to notice we didn't have an episode last week that was a revisited episode, and that's because me and my whole family are sick, and we were all in bed by like 8:30 all week long. I tried to stay up Wednesday night to do this, and oh my gosh, I was asleep within like 10 minutes of sitting at the computer. I just had to rest. I could not will my body to stay up, and which is when I usually work on this show, nights and weekends, because I work during the day. And anyway, I hate to keep having excuses for y'all, just because I feel like it's been happening a lot, but life's just been crazy. And anything that gets thrown off this show, unfortunately, you know, I got a lot of other things I got to get done, but I am back on track. And the good news is we're coming back with an episode that is already, it's an instant classic. This is Wes Hansen, baby. This is this is adventure right here. Those kinds of adventures that you read about in books 100 years later. So let me put this into perspective for you. We had Wes on a couple years ago to talk about his adventure that was the Amazon River from source to sea. I'm talking like the source, the farthest trickle on a mountain pass front that could be considered the Amazon River, all the way to the Atlantic Ocean. And that was crazy. And there's a book, he was a legend after that. He's done the Volga River, source to sea, and that's kind of his jam. Well, when he learned about the Northwest Passage, which is basically the path going from Europe to Asia north of Canada, because right now, obviously, you got to go south of South America, or you got to go through the Panama Canal. But the Northwest Passage is estimated to cut off like 10 days of transit from shipments to Europe to Asia and back and forth. So it is the world is watching when the Northwest Passage is going to open. And the reason it's going to open is because the world is getting warmer and the climate's changing and the sea ice is melting incredibly rapidly. In fact, you're going to hear from Wes, locals were talking like 5-10 years ago that this was not even even remotely possible. And now it's almost, going to be easily doable in the next few years. Well, this is the window where people were trying to go for it and be the first teams to do this by human power. Well, Wes and his team succeeded. There were other teams out there, and it was a 1,600-mile, 83-day, sub-zero, sub-freezing adventure that was just brutal. And you're going to hear just how challenging and how dark and how cold and how unavoidable the danger was. Over 100 days spent on the water, but only 83 of them were in the actual Northwest Passage. It was a couple weeks on either end approaching and then leaving the passage itself. And if you do look it up and you do search it for it on the internet, you will see there's some controversy around this adventure because Wes and his team did camp on this island that they weren't supposed to because there was this this migratory birds there or this bird nesting, and it sounded like it was an emergency. Anyway, Wes and I agreed before the episode that we weren't going to talk about it just because they got in legal trouble with the Canadian government, and it's this big thing and it's not complete yet. So while things are still up in the air and it's getting worked out, he didn't want to comment on it. And so I was like, totally fine. There's plenty of other stuff to talk about. So if you look it up, you'll probably, if you look up the expedition and their name, you might see that. TBD, there's more to come there. But if you're looking for information about that, well, you're not going to find it here. So thank you so much, Wes, for the time, for the adventure and the inspiration. And thanks for being open. As y'all hear at the end, he's really open about how this affects his life, how this, the pros and cons of being basically good at expeditions. And that's the side of adventure we all don't always get to talk about it. So I'm really glad he opened up. So, all right, let's dive in. Wes Hansen, welcome to Adventure Sports Podcast. How you doing?
Doing great, Mason. I appreciate you having me back.
Yeah, man. I tell you what, we the last time we had you on was to talk about the Amazon from source to sea. And that was, that was one of the all-time most epic adventures in the sense of, a first, world's longest. It's one of those things that you think of and it's like going to the moon. It's like, really? We're going to do that? And you've done it. So today we're talking about something that I think's even wilder, even more iconic of a first, and that's the Northwest Passage. So, but first, you're not coming from up in the Arctic Circle. Where are you coming from today?
Well, I'm in Austin, Texas. This is where I've lived for the past few decades. I went to college just south of here in a little town called San Marcos, and I'm a native Texan. I've never lived outside of Texas. Not that I'm opposed to it. It just hadn't occurred yet.
I want to hear, you got this idea a handful of years ago. Tell us about this grueling 83-day journey that you completed last year, but tell us where the idea started. I know that you had done some major stuff, but were you just looking for another first? Tell us why the Northwest Passage.
Well, it's a combination of things, and it's not as, like with most of these endeavors, it's not as simple as just a single idea. When I found the Northwest Passage, I'd been doing a lot of reading about Roald Amundsen. I collect first edition books about historic expeditions or first edition books about historic expeditions. And once I get a hold of a person or an expedition, I try to read up everything I can about him. And I came across Roald Amundsen's book about his expedition to the South Pole. He was the first to be there. It was an actual race against Robert Falcon Scott. Roald Amundsen was outspent. He was outgeared. By all practical purposes, he shouldn't have even made it. But not only did Roald Amundsen succeed at being the first person to the South Pole, but all his team members did great. They gained weight. They did it in a very fast time. He was very successful, primarily because of what he learned when he was the first person to navigate the Northwest Passage. And so I went down that rabbit hole and I read all the books about his expedition to the Northwest Passage, which was done in the same vein. He had a group of six, and he succeeded over a 3-year period, over wintering twice, when huge expeditions had failed, including the famous expedition led by John Franklin, where 143 men simply disappeared, only later to be remnants of them to be found. So that spurred my interest in the Northwest Passage. Then I started reading about modern day expeditions of people trying to row the Northwest Passage and kayak the Northwest Passage. And it was at that point I realized that no one had successfully done so. Now I'm interested because I like doing things that haven't been done before, you know, as evidenced by the Amazon. I mean, we were the first expedition down the Amazon from its most distant source. And then once again, the Volga River 2 years later. It just, I'm really enamored by that and finding out what happened that someone hadn't been able to do this yet, and covering those bases and seeing if we can overcome whatever, you know, obstacles they had before me. And so that led to the Northwest Passage. I started planning it about 5 years ago.
So with something this big, there's a lot of variables, of course, and one of them comes down to team. What's your process with like selecting how many people? I recently did a small adventure in comparison, and I was very careful not to invite too many people just because that would almost make it less doable. How do you strike that balance with something like this that's never been done? There's the brutality of the cold, and also, I mean, there's going to be a lot of people that might be interested, but maybe not so serious. Like, how did you go about that?
Well, yeah, I'm still learning that. There's no formula, and you nailed it, that the team is paramount. And there are several successful expeditions out there that you can kind of model after, but every expedition is unique. What I think I found is that an odd number of people is best, as opposed to an even number.
You took four, didn't you?
Well, we did end up with four. That wasn't the plan, though. We started in 2022 with three of us in solo kayaks. It was me, Jeff Wiestey, and Rebecca Feaster. And actually, we had four to start with. Jenny Harvey was going to join us, and he later backed out and ended up joining Freya Hoffmeister in her attempt this past year to go through the Northwest Passage. But we initially started with three in solo kayaks because then, you know, with an odd number, the dynamic seems to work better. There aren't factions that develop. And also you could have, if somebody's injured, you can have one person stay with the injured party while the other person goes for help. And then when our 2022 expedition, we had to bail out of that after about 260 miles, we learned a lot. We reformed a team and we tried to grow the team and have a lot more people in order to be able to carry more gear, which we were going to need as an unsupported expedition, also for safety. So there'd be more people watching out for one another. We advertised on Facebook. We first hit up all the ultra marathon canoe and kayakers that we knew, and people just weren't able to make it for various reasons. I mean, taking 4 months off and spending this much money, it's a big thing to overcome for most people. Oh, yeah. and just impossible for others. And so we put out an advertisement on Facebook, and we had about 38 people that were interested, some of which had never sat in a kayak, but were very willing. Mm-hmm. Others with significant experience, but their personalities didn't necessarily match up. So we ended up doing a lot of interviews and coming down to five people. One of those people, Jack Hopkins, who's extremely strong, monster of a man, an ocean rower, came down to Texas and paddled with us for a while. We determined, as Jack did as well, that, you know, his skills weren't what we're going to be needing up there, and safety was a big concern. So Jack backed out. And granted, I think given more time, a few more months, I think Jack would have been a wonderful addition to the team. But with ocean rowing as his base, it didn't transfer that well to kayaking. Yeah, so we ended up with four. And that was Dr. Eileen Visser, who's a marine biologist at St. Lawrence College up in upstate New York, and Mark Agnew, who is from the UK. And once again, he had some experience with ocean rowing, but moreover, he had a wide variety of athletic experience and was young and strong and very willing to learn the kayaking that he needed to. And so that's what he did out in the UK before the expedition. So that's how we ended up with the four of us.
So you have a worldwide, basically, group of folks. At least, even in the U.S., you're spread out pretty decent. You and Jeff are close by, but Eileen is up in New York. Like, how do you create the chemistry and the, you know, the confidence in each other that say, we're going to meet each other in the Arctic, Dagom Arctic Circle and do this? Like, that, you know what I mean? That's quite a huge ask for folks that don't live nearby.
Yeah, and that was a bit trying. I, you know, naively, you know, thought everybody thought that I did, and apparently that's not the case. And so we learned that up there, and there were some growing pains we had to go through throughout the entire expedition. So, you know, in an ideal world, the team comes together for several months, and we spend time together, training, learning each other's personalities, working out any differences, but we didn't have that option this time. And so we were all just kind of thrown into this soup. The first time the team was all together was in Ottawa when we were on our way flying to the Arctic. Eileen flew down twice to Texas, and we paddled with her for a day or so on the Gulf of Mexico. And that's where we figured out that, you know, she had the skills to drive one of these boats. But other than that, we hadn't spent much time at all. It was like first date scenario, you know, and everybody gets along great on a first date. But once you're 30 years into a marriage, yeah, things are a little more tense.
Yeah, they can be, that's for sure. They have their moments.
Well, and to that end, and I'd like to be very transparent here. There were issues throughout the entire expedition that were never resolved personality wise between us, and I fault myself as a leader. I found several deficits in my own leadership style that I'll improve on in future expeditions. And I fell down on the job up there. It was only for the resilience of all four of our members that came in that we succeeded. I mean, I was hardcore about safety and only allowing the team to paddle during conditions that I was confident they could you know, not only make forward progress, but survive. So the differences we had throughout the entire expedition, fortunately, weren't enough to stop the expedition, and we were all able to move forward. But I learned a lot as an expedition leader about my own inabilities that I need to improve on, or my own faults as a leader. So that was a big problem, and it was inherent with the, you know, short amount of time that we put the team together. And I'm not sure any way around it yet, but I do know that this is an issue that I'll need to be working on.
So you have other ideas for things to do. This isn't like, well, I did it. I ain't doing that again.
No. This is apparently a terminal condition I have that I'll be doing many more expeditions after this. And I really want to bring on more team members and new team members for these expeditions, primarily women. I think there's a lack of women participating in these ultra distance kayaking expeditions that are out in the middle of nowhere. There are some very talented women out there who are extremely capable, and I hope they start venturing more into this, and because I think the perspective that men and women have is different when they're approaching things in life because of how, you know, cultures have treated us differently. And I think the addition that women have to an expedition is extremely valuable.
Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that help make this show possible. Are you looking to sell anything at all online? Well, I would advise you to look into Shopify. They are a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. I use Shopify every day at my day job. It has been with us since our company was a tiny little team all the way up to where we are today, one of the biggest breweries in the country. Whether you're auctioning off autographed apparel, selling sleek skis, or selling non-alcoholic beer like we are at Athletic Brewing, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their personal POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. We manage a podcast, a blog, all that right there on our Shopify store. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. and has extensive help resources for whenever you're dealing with an obstacle. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ASP, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ASP for Adventure Sports Podcast now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ASP. That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode.
Yeah, the first one that comes to mind to me is Sally O'Donnell, who...
Oh, Sally's amazing, yeah.
Yeah, good friend, and just, I mean, like her, you know, you look at her, and her husband, he loves talking about this. He goes, these big, gruff guys just can't understand why they can't pass her, can't understand why they can't keep up. You know, there's this smiling, smaller woman that just is flying through the water. They're like, I should just be able to muscle through this, and they can't, and it's so frustrating. And you just see their morale deplete and throughout a long distance race or something. And it's right, just the way, you know, I think she's a great example of just like it. It's not, you can't judge a book by its cover, and it's just a matter of having those right skill sets that can just take you hundreds and hundreds of miles and faster than anyone else, and also more efficient, and also with a better attitude. So there's just so much going on with folks like that. I think you're right. The door's not open for everybody.
Well, and to that end, I think Sally's an excellent example of how, if you look at, you know, just hardcore numbers and race stats with ultra marathon racing, either, you know, on leg, on bike, or in the water on canoes and kayaks or surf skis, the differences between men and women diminish with the length, and the longer the event or the endeavor, the closer you're going to have between the men and the women finishers, the times. And the same holds true for expeditions. You know, women have a much more efficient strength to weight ratio, and so they're not going to have to pull as much weight as a man for the strength to weight ratio. In other words, for a guy to be as strong as a woman, proportional to their weight, they have to be supermen. You know, they've got to be extremely strong.
You see that in climbing too.
Yes, exactly. And women tend to be a little bit more efficient in climbing because I think from what I've seen, they learn early on to use their legs much more efficiently than men climbers. And finally, I think the men are starting to catch up to that idea, but the point I'm getting at is I don't see any physical difference between men and women ultramarathon canoe racers or explorers for their abilities at all. The rest comes down to just individual personalities, and that's not a thing you can separate by the sexes, because there are men out there who are great, and there are men out there who are jerks, and there are women out there who are great, and there are women out there who are jerks. It really is not a, you know, sex-based thing.
Right.
So physically, and endurance wise, I sure hope to see more women out there, and we're going to be trying to get more women on our expeditions.
Very cool. That's awesome. So let's talk a little bit about the Northwest Passage itself. You know, this has been a long sought after trade route, just because it does cut down on the distances that boats would have to travel. But what is officially considered the Northwest Passage? I saw the goal was to get from the Baffin Bay to the Beaufort Sea. Is that basically any way you get between those two bodies of water is considered the Northwest Passage?
That's correct. And there are multiple ways you can do it. Any way through the Canadian Arctic Archipelago. And for the listeners out there who aren't familiar with this, the Northwest Passage is is located north of the Canadian mainland. And up there, there's an archipelago, or a body of islands, which is an archipelago, that lies between the Canadian mainland and the North Pole. And so the passage is any route that goes from Baffin Bay, which is the large body of water on the eastern portion of the Northwest Passage, to the Beaufort Sea, which is on the western portion. And a passage, by definition, has to go between a strait. You have to, and strait is S-T-R-A-I-T, that kind of strait. So you can't have a passage that goes to the ocean. There has to be some kind of land-based boundaries. There has to be a strait, and that's the ocean, you know, hydrologically speaking, and according to a maritime law, a passage is through a strait. And so any one of these straits that goes through this archipelago is the Northwest Passage. And so they're any one of those ways can be deemed a Northwest Passage.
To kind of put why this was such a sought after area, the reason this wasn't passable is because of ice. So what is happening? Tell us about, because I know that was part of the reason you did this, is the only reason you were able to do it is because it's becoming more and more possible to do it.
You're exactly right, Mason. And as you mentioned earlier, the passage was an exploration of the Northwest Passage was not based upon science or adventure or anything like that. It was commerce based. It was based upon money. The trade route between either whaling or sealing industry, because whale oil and seal oil were the primary means of lamps lighting up homes back in the, you know, hundreds of years ago up till now.
Whale oil.
And so that industry pushed whalers and sealers further north, but then also once it was discovered that or theorized that our globe was round after the Contamine expedition in the 1700s, after Newtonian physics came into play, that we no longer thought the Earth was an hourglass shape, but it was a globe. And it was also theorized that the North Pole was a tropical paradise full of water, and that all we had to do was get through the ice ring around it in order to cross over the top of the Earth. You know, that's obviously since been disproven, but throughout the 1700s and 1800s, that was a popular belief. Suffice it to say, European traders and Asian traders back then, called the Orient, wanted to be able to trade back and forth quickly. The Panama Canal didn't exist, so the only way between the Pacific and the Atlantic Oceans was around Cape Horn, which was extremely dangerous, the tip of South America. Mm.
Yeah, Drake's Passage.
Yes, exactly. And that was just rife with storms where these two oceans meet. Therefore, it only left the northern route, which is the Northwest Passage. It had been traversed over ice, but ships had not been able to make it. And so that was, you know, commerce drove exploration up there. And that's why Franklin's expedition went up there and the John Ross expedition and several other famous expeditions. But until 1906, when Roald Amundsen made it through there, it was ice bound and no ocean navigation was possible. Well, that leads to our expedition, which is the elephant in the room. Due to climate change, now the passage is becoming more and more predictably open for months at a time. In fact, you know, it's not predictable that, you know, every year you can go up there and you can assume that it's going to be ice free because, you know, even 2 years before we went, their icebreakers couldn't make it through. But in 2022 and 2023, when we eventually made it through in 2023, the passage was not only open from mid June, but it stayed open through December. And that's unheard of. And our Inuit and Eskimo friends that we met up there and helped support our expedition talked in detail about the changes they've seen over the decades and then finally the more recent years. The change is very quickly occurring now. I mean, they will see changes from a year-to-year basis that they've never seen before. So The passage is an open passage is becoming a reality. I mean, we had some ice problems early on, but really after 4 weeks or even 3 weeks, we didn't have any ice issues.
Because the season's progressing and it's getting warmer and melting more ice even. Were you dealing with any commercial boats or anything like that at that point? Or is it still too early in this change for that to be something you're running into on a frequent basis?
It's still fairly early. And right now what we did see were cruise ships because very expensive cruise lines are going up there. They take less of a risk, financial risk, than freighters, for instance, because, mm-hmm. you know, you can get passengers on a cruise ship and they pay their money up front. And the owner of the cruise line has their money. And even if they can't make it through, they say, okay, well, we tried. Thanks for the ship. And the passengers know ahead of time they may not be able to make it through. Whereas, you know, a large ship full of containers is counting on that revenue. They can't go up there and turn around. I mean, then all of a sudden they've got lost money. So it's got to be a lot more predictable. But we are quickly working towards that predictability. And I guarantee you, those cruise lines are probably more closely, they're watching it more closely than anybody on the planet, because as you mentioned, it's wide open. There are no fees to go through the Northwest Passage as there are with Panama Canal. There's no clogged lines. Right now, a ship pulling up to the Panama Canal has to wait several weeks to get through. And so what they can do is they pay, in essence, what are bribes, up to $5 million per ship to get moved up closer to the front of the line. Some shipping companies like Maersk have just given it up altogether, and they're pulling up there and they're unloading their ships on rail lines, taking them across the Panama Canal, and loading them up on other ships to go because the waits are so long.
Good gracious.
Yeah, it's a real, I mean, they're working to expand the Panama Canal, but it's just not fast enough for the demand. Whereas the Northwest Passage is roughly 10 days faster between Europe and Asia. And you have no cyclones, no hurricanes. You do have storms, but they're not as bad as cyclones and hurricanes out in the middle of the Atlantic and Pacific. And there's no waiting. So it's faster. They use less fuel. It's safer. All they're waiting on now is the ice to melt.
What an interesting change. Now, based on what you read, all your research, and seeing these accounts from 100 years ago or more, what did you see physically as like one of the most stark results of that change? You know, it could have just been a bunch of ice that was not there anymore, or a feature that you recognized from a book, or just, you know, like, was there anything that really stood out as far as like, wow, that's a big change?
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, because there is some. And the biggest thing, which may not be readily available to the lay eye, but if you look into it, is the almost complete loss of sea ice. Now, there are different types of ice that you can see out on the ocean. You can see icebergs and this, that, and the other. But sea ice is actually frozen sea. What we saw out there was drift ice. Now, drift ice freezes further north and it drifts down. And that's all the ice we saw. And the drift ice can also become fast ice. Fast ice is ice that's secured fast to the shore. So the only ice we saw was fast ice and drift ice. We saw no sea ice at all. The ice that drifted into Pond Inlet and Eclipse Sound, where our plane landed for the, you know, to get ready for the launch, was primarily drift ice. There's very little sea ice. And if it is, it's much thinner. The people in the Inuit communities talked about how much more dangerous it is to take their snowmobiles over the sea ice, because they fall through. It's just a lot thinner than it's ever been.
How long ago are we talking that there was substantial sea ice?
5 years.
Wow.
10 years. It's recent. And the change is drastic. And, you know, we wouldn't have been able to made it through if there were sea ice. But the drift ice, if we had ice like during the first 3 weeks of our expedition that was coming through, we simply have to wait 3 or 4 days and it would drift out of the way. Mm-hmm. We had some very dangerous situations when we were kayaking through the drift ice, and it started moving very quickly, and it almost crushed us twice between two huge sheets of ice when we were making our way through this maze of moving ice. But, you know, we always had the option of just waiting, and it would have just moved out of the way eventually.
Before we, I want to hear some stories from the trip, but you weren't the only team trying to be the first to do this. There was almost kind of like with the South Pole, there was a rush to get down there. How closely were you keeping tabs on some of these other teams?
Oh, very closely. We all got to know each other beforehand, and we kind of kept an eyes on one another. I mean, it was a very friendly competition.
Good.
It really was. And we got to know, you know, in particularly Matty Clark and Adam. They were the two solo rowers, and they were coming the opposite direction. And I talked to them ahead of time, and we kept tabs on them constantly. And Matty eventually, Adam Riley came out early on with a shoulder injury after a week or so. So that was heartbreaking. And then Matty continued on his own and ended up damaging his boat and having some issues there. So he came out in Joya Haven. And God, we felt bad about that. You know, he was running out of time. I know that. And he made a very prudent decision, but we really wanted him to make it. And it broke our heart. Now, Levin Brown had a team of 8 rowers on a giant ocean rowing rig that was making really good time. And they eventually came out as well. When they, you know, it turned out their boat really couldn't handle the wind and waves of the passage, which are far different than an ocean, open ocean. And then Freya Hoffmeister was out there, and she was with our buddy Jimmy. Now, Jimmy just lives across town from me, Jimmy Harvey. We've raced together, and we've been on teams together, and he was originally on our expedition. So they were in two solo kayaks coming from Tuckyaktuk, and their goal was to make Cambridge Bay, which was roughly halfway. And then the other team was the other person trying to make the passage was Carl Kruger, stand-up paddleboarder, and he was just doing it a section at a time, and he did really well. And you know, once again,
on a paddleboard,
yeah.
Holy crap!
Yeah, I know. Exactly. Not me, especially up there. It's windy,
my toes hurt just thinking about.
I know. Carl's quite the guy, but anyway, so we did keep tabs on one another. We all, you know, had transponders, and our support teams talked with one another, and you know, that's just not a place up there to be cutthroat. You got to kind of keep an eye out for each other. We never got to see any of the other people. We knew what they were doing and where they were. I'm glad to see people up there doing that. And there are more people going next year. In fact, I've got a meeting this afternoon with two guys that want to kayak the Northwest Passage. I'm going to try to help them out. I always figure it's our duty to do that for people getting out there trying to do things. In fact, I've been corresponding with a woman wanting to paddle the Amazon River and trying to help her out.
Absolutely. So, no, I'm glad you're able to share some of that knowledge and information. There's plenty other obstacles to slow people down and keep people from getting records and all that. But gosh, you know, if you you can share everything, you can give them every bit of detail, and it could still be a total, you know, failure on their end, just due to a number of variables that could happen at any point.
You're absolutely right.
I want to hear more about this drifting ice. You're talking about. So that's something I didn't realize was such a danger, because one thing I wanted to ask is what are some of the true dangers? There's always like those the layman dangers where you tell somebody about something, they're like, oh, there's alligators or there's sharks or these things that are kind of misunderstood as a danger. But the true danger is usually different: drowning or the drive to the adventure itself, or you know, any number of things. What were some of those actual things that were a challenge? I'm sure one of the first people say is polar bears, but what was really a day-to-day thing you had to be careful of?
Well, the drift ice, as we talked about earlier, it is very fast moving chunks of ice. They're rarely more than they're usually flat ice right at water level. You could roll over onto them and crawl up on them if you want. They're about the size of, you know, a large house or a lot. Sometimes they're smaller, you know, pancake size, about the size of a car, or even smaller chunks than that. And these travel in herds, and they could be, 20 miles long, or they could be 100 yards long. It's this drift ice, and they flow with the tide and the wind, primarily the wind. The tide does have some effect up there, but none of the tides are very strong in the Northwest Passage, except through Bellot Strait. The tides really, we didn't have to pay attention to it at all, except where it had an effect upon the drift ice. We only encountered drift ice from the start to Bellot Strait, which was about a third of the way through. And then after that, it wasn't an issue. It was non-existent at all throughout the rest of the expedition. But up until then, we had to weave our way through it. Sometimes we had to wait out several days. It's just fast ice coming through that'll crush your boat.
Yeah, what is the danger? I mean, it's not like 10-foot walls of ice closing in on you like an Indiana Jones booby trap, but it is enough and enough weight to just basically pinch your boat and crush it and sink it, right?
Right, and it moves fast, like, you know, 5 to 10 miles an hour, that fast. Good, so, gracious. Yeah, so, and then it drifts, you know, even if we're weaving, you know, when we're trying to make our way through a band of drift ice, which may be a mile wide, and we're working our way through it, the ice is constantly moving. Now, if you're in placid water, then it's not moving that much, and you can kind of squeeze through place here or there. Some places are wider, and it's not that big a deal. But if all of a sudden it starts moving with different flows and different directions, then all of a sudden you're in the middle of these massive multi-ton chunks of ice that are crushing together, and they're making these horrible crunching noises as they slam together. Now, they don't come up in pressure ridges like, you know, going to the North Pole or something, but they do push one another away around.
And if you're in there.
Yeah, and you can easily get crushed. Luckily, both our boats were in that situation when we were trying to get through. And fortunately, because of the round hulls, we were pushed up instead of crushed.
But that wasn't a known before you left.
No, oh, no. And we know that Friedrich Nansen designed a boat, the Fram, to do that, to be forced up when he was trying to make a North Pole run. And the Joya, the boat that was used by Roald Amundsen, was the same design, with the idea that instead of being crushed, they would be shoved up. Well, inadvertently, that's what happened with us, and we were shoved up. I wouldn't recommend anybody go through drift ice. If someone does, they just need to make sure that it's not moving fast. I mean, in hindsight, obviously, we learned a lot. The one time that we were almost crushed, the ice was moving very quickly, but it didn't start until we were in the middle of it. We were easily trying to make our way through the bank, which was only, I mean, it was less than a mile away. We could see the mountains. We could see our goal after making a 38-mile crossing of almost 45-mile crossing of Prince Regent Inlet. And there it was. The land was right there. We just had to get through this little bit of ice that was only a mile wide. And that's when it started speeding up and became a problem. In hindsight, you know, if we knew it was going to start moving, we could have just kept going south and, you know, another 10 or 15 miles and gotten around the drift ice. But we don't know how long the drift ice is. It's something you can't see on a satellite, you know, especially if you have an overcast sky. There's no accurate satellite imagery of drift ice.
And probably not a great view from the kayak itself, right?
Exactly. You're right on the water, so all you can see is, you know, drift ice and drift ice, whereas it may go away after 100 yards. You just can't see it. What we had to do after we were, you know, almost crushed was we dragged the kayaks up on top of one of these slabs of moving ice.
Which are stable enough to walk on.
Yeah, these usually. Are some aren't. The smaller ones obviously will tump over, but the larger ones, obviously, you know, I mean, are just huge. I mean, they're as big as a lot of land, and you know, maybe 100 feet by 100 feet. And so we crawled up on one, very stable, but you're up there freezing to death. You can't just linger, you know, on a sheet of ice. So what we did in that situation was we dragged the boats from one chunk of ice to another till we came to the edge of the ice flow, and then. And that's very turbulent also, because you have this, you know, raft of ice, huge chunks of ice pushing their way forward very fast. So we had to launch without getting shoved up underneath this thing.
Oh, my gosh.
And so the wheels are very quick launch, and then we sprinted away to the shore after that. But that was a bit harrowing. So that's a big problem with the Northwest Passage.
No kidding. Good Lord. Well, one of the things that I mean, this would be just... horrible is for if the boat, for some reason, I don't know the design or the shape of the ice or the thickness, it pushed your boat under and pinched you. I mean, that sounds like a Final Destination movie or something. Just like if that was a risk, but the fact that it worked the way it did, the physics of it, I mean, it's better than some of the alternatives, or just straight up crushing the boat, breaking it apart and then pulling apart, and there's, you know, everything sinks that's not, you know, can float. So good Lord, man, that is unbelievable. And the fact that it's unpredictable is so difficult. Well, what were some of the other things?
Well, and once again, the situation in those two potential crushings could have been different if those slabs of ice had been taller, the edges had been taller. Whereas they just went up underneath our hull. They were closer to the water, excuse me. But if they were a foot taller, we would have been killed. There would have been
killed.
And it would have been really, and not one of those happy deaths, you know, surrounded by your family and friends. No, this would have been a really ugly death.
Or quick. It wouldn't be quick either.
No. It'd be very cold and painful and crushing. So now imagine that scenario, us working through, you know, the drift ice. Well, 2 days later, after we had camped and we'd gotten our bearings and we're starting to work our way through the drift ice to go south again through Prince Regent Inlet, that we're working through these thin leads, these little water openings in the ice, like a maze, and you kind of got to back out and find another one, this, that, and the other. Well, there's this one lead up ahead of us about 50 yards that was the only open lead where we were, and there's a polar bear and her cub right in that lead hunting seals.
Ain't no way.
Yeah, way. And it's like, you know, really, the only place we can go, and it's their backyard. What are you going to do? Say shoo? No. So we had to back out and try to find another way. Now polar bears, you got to be careful of polar bears. They yeah. they really, if they ever organized themselves, they'd take over our species in no time. As it is, they're loners. But if they were pack hunters, there's no way you could fight these things, because they are all terrain vehicles. They mm-hmm. swim like fish in any water conditions. They swim through ice, under ice, over ice. They can swim in the surf. They can climb cliffs. We saw them climb cliffs like squirrels. They can go straight up a cliff. They're fast runners. They're omnivores. So they could chase you over any terrain, water or land, up a mountain, and they can eat anything they want. I mean, they're really the perfect hunter and survivor. Well, it's their back. It's their, luckily they're also very intelligent. They're not psychotic. grizzly bears are psychotic. So they're just in attack mode constantly. Whereas polar bears, it's like, okay, I'm curious, but I'm not an idiot. I may walk into your camp, but I'm not going to hang around if I'm not wanted. So they were pretty easy to scare off with the exploding flares. We had movement sensors when we were in our tent. So anytime something would come in the radius that we had set up with these movement sensors, the alarm would go off and the bears would be scared off. We'd be alerted to jump out. Sometimes we had to fire a shotgun into the air. But by and large, they didn't want to be around us. You know, the curious ones would come up, but once again, once they knew they were unwelcome, they'd run off. Except for one. You know, there's always one.
Yeah.
It's that guy. You know, it's that clueless guy at a strip club who says, you know, I think she likes me. You know, you have that one bear. Yeah. Who just doesn't get it. And unfortunately, the last one we saw was just shy of our halfway point where we got our resupply at Cambridge Bay, the town of Cambridge Bay. We were woken up by a bear brushing up against the side of our tent. Fired a flare, fired a shotgun. It wouldn't go away. So we jumped out of the tent, used harsh language. And he was very lethargic. And we guessed that he must have been sick because he just hung around for about an hour. Well, you know, what do? We don't want to kill the guy. I mean, he doesn't feel well, and he's not threatening us at all. Just hanging out, wanting, I don't know, some antibiotics or some lettuce to soothe his aching stomach. We don't know. He was fat, luckily. If he was skinny bear is a dangerous bear. But this guy hung around for about an hour and finally ambled off. And we didn't hang around that camp long after that. You know, we got the hell out of there. But all other bears ran from us, fortunately.
Polar bears hunt humans or have no problem hunting humans in the sense of the only bear species that does that. So I didn't know if y'all ran into that much or what, but it sounds like they behaved like a lot of other bears do, not really wanting to be around humans. So that's fortunate.
And we saw polar bears almost daily, literally daily. Now, there might be a day or two we didn't, but it was rare that a day went by we didn't see at least one, sometimes up to four or five polar bears.
Wow.
No, it was not a rare thing. We got really used to them. I wouldn't say we got complacent. We were very on alert the whole time, but we did get used to them. And we had all the safeguards in place, that we learned from the Inuit and we were constantly vigilant.
What about some of the other dangers? Anything in the water, the ice, of course, the bears, obviously the cold. Like, let's talk about that. If there's no orcas or anything to deal with, like you're from Texas. I don't know about you. I don't do well in the cold, you know, born and raised in Florida. I've lived in mountainous areas and never really adjusted. How did y'all deal with that element?
Well, while we were in the kayaks and moving, fortunately we, the dry suits weren't all that dry. They would get wet inside, but even when we were wet, we were able to stay somewhat warm. So while we were moving, everything was fine. The nightmare, two times a day that were nightmares, were getting into our kayaks and getting out of our kayaks, because then we had to change from our land gear into our paddling gear and back again. And in between that time, the gear you're putting on is cold, and also you're naked. I mean, you're completely naked in the Arctic because there's no transitional gear. And it was mainly our hands, because we'd have to have our gloves off in order to put on zippers and tie shoes and things of that nature. So our hands really suffered, and it would take them up to 30 minutes to an hour to warm up either on land or on the water once we had our pogies on. with our kayak paddles. The cold was significant. It was bearable. We were able to warm up fairly easily from the start all the way to the halfway point at Cambridge Bay, the town of Cambridge Bay. But after Cambridge Bay, it got daily colder. We had some sunny days, which were great, but it got quickly and progressively colder. And the going joke was the Game of Thrones. Jon Snow was his name, I think. Winter is coming. I mean, we knew it was coming, and it was coming in fast. The days were getting shorter. We started out with 24 hours of daylight, but then after halfway point, the darkness started creeping in, and we had more darkness than light. Yeah, our paddling time became shorter each day, and it got cold and cold and cold.
What are some of these temperatures we're talking about?
You know, that's funny you ask, and I've been asked that before. When we'd get our daily reports from our home base, and my sister Barbara Eddington was our expedition manager, and Tom McGuire helped her out. He was our tech guy. They would send us daily weather reports in the morning and the evening, so we could predict how we could go the next day or what would happen. I never wanted to hear the temperature. And I told him, and the one time they did tell me, I said, don't ever tell me the temperature, because it doesn't matter.
What are you going to do?
It won't matter. Tell me the wind, wind speed, wind direction, wave speed, the height of the wave, this, that, and the other. But I did not want, I thought it'd be so depressing, so I never knew. It was sub freezing. The last 3 weeks never got over freezing. I could tell because our GoPro lithium batteries stopped working. They were fully charged, and they were so fully charged as when they were in my pocket, but as soon as I brought them out in the cold weather, they would last only 3 to 5 seconds. And they would say, charge down. And then I found out later on, oh yeah, that's the thing with these lithium batteries. Towards the end, the last 3 weeks, we would paddle and the paddle splash would get on top of the kayaks and immediately freeze. So we'd finish the day with ice crusted on top of the kayaks. We had snowstorms that would pile drifts up as high as our tent. We had one tent and we'd all crowd in there and the snow would just be packed up against it. We had 40 to 50, sometimes 60 mile an hour winds in some of these camps. And we'd have to wait out 5 or 6 days for the weather to, you know, to be amenable to paddling. Because the winds were so torrential. They eventually knocked out Leavens rowing team. They couldn't row in these type of winds, and they couldn't camp on shore. Their boat wouldn't, they couldn't land their boat. Whereas we could land, and we counted on landing every day to the safety of shore. So the cold towards the end was the coldest I'd ever been in my life. We had warm enough gear, but just warm enough. By the last week and a half, I was sleeping in every bit of clothing I had. Socks, coat, underlayers, everything. And I was fine. I was okay in the sleeping bag. But, you know, I couldn't have gotten any colder, that's for sure.
Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that help make this show possible.
With any adventure, hydration is very important. I've been on so many trips where I've been dehydrated or couldn't stay hydrated enough, and Element helps anyone, including especially adventurers, stay hydrated. Without the sugar and other dodgy ingredients found in popular electrolyte and sports drinks, you don't want to have cramps and headaches and fatigue and brain fog or weakness on trips, whether that's training or out on the adventure itself. And having the ability to have something like Element there is so important. Element is a zero sugar electrolyte drink mix free of all the sugar and artificial coloring. Element was developed by former research biochemist Rob Wolf, 2 times New York Times bestselling author and one of the Navy SEAL Resiliency Committee members for over a decade. From Olympic athletes to special forces to health experts to business leaders to everyday health, Element is their go-to choice for hydration. Our listeners can receive a free Element sample pack with any order when you go to drinkelement.com/adventuresports. That's drinkelement.com/adventuresports. And you can try Element totally risk-free. If you don't like it, give it away to a friend and they'll give you your money back. No questions asked. I've been using it on rides and paddles lately and I'm really enjoying it. Element, stay salty. Football season may be over, but the action on the floor is heating up. Whether it's tournament season, or the fight for playoff home court. There's no shortage of high-stakes basketball moments this time of year. Get in on the excitement with Prize Picks, America's number one fantasy sports app, where you can turn your hoops knowledge into serious cash. I'm a big NBA fan, so I might be getting in on the action with some NBA games this playoff season. Prize Picks is the best way to get action on sports in more than 30 states across the country, including California, Texas, and Georgia. Testing your skills on Prize Picks this season is the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. If you have the skills, you can turn $10 into $1,000 with just a few taps. It's really simple to play. You can make your picks and submit your entry in less than 60 seconds. Download the app today and use ASP for a first deposit match up to $100. Again, download the Prize Picks app today and use the code ASP for a first deposit match up to $100. Pick more, pick less. It's that easy.
That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode. What would you say the hardest moment, the crux of this experience where, I don't know, was there doubt that maybe entered your mind? I mean, just progressively getting colder and darker seems very, seems like it isn't the way you want adventures to go. You almost wanted to get brighter and sunnier and more enjoyable as it goes on. But this sounded just like it was getting harder the longer you were out there.
It was. You know, that's interesting. I've been asked that question after every expedition, and I've never, ever doubted that we could finish. You know, on the Amazon, on the Volga, on this. I mean, when things got hard, even on this. And we were getting down to, you know, our food stores, too. There were a couple of team members, they insisted on eating 6,000 calories a day, whereas a couple of us knew we could subsist on a lot less. You know, we were eating about 1,000 a day, calories a day by the end. And, but at the same time, you know, with only a couple of hundred miles left, I felt pretty confident I could make it with no food. I mean, if we paddled 24 hours a day, sure, paddling through the dark, but we've paddled through the dark. I'm experienced, you know, with the canoe racing in the dark, either in the Alabama 650. Or
make it with no food. You mean just not eating for the last few days?
Yeah, but I don't think it would have gotten to that. In other words, we had some calories. We had protein mix and this, that, and the other. We had enough to finish, even if we were out there another couple of weeks. But the food, we were rationing the food at the end. But even with that, I never doubted we could finish. You know, you just have to adapt. And people can go without food. I don't think we would have had to go without food, calories. And we had water. But that's something that just never enters my mind. I think mainly because there's really no option. I mean, what are you going to do? Quit? You're out in the middle of nowhere. You know, I know there was a team member who thought about calling in the Coast Guard if we ran out of food. And I thought, no, that's not going to happen. I'm not going to call the Coast Guard because I'm out of food. I'm not going to, you know, that's just not an option. And to that end, we had insurance, expedition insurance. So if we did have to call the Coast Guard, the Canadian taxpayers would not have to foot the bill. We had it fully covered. And I wanted to make sure that everybody knew that. And we you know, we weren't going to cost anybody any money. I don't know. It's just when you're not given the option, you just got to finish, you know?
All this is on top of not even talking about the condition of the ocean and the water itself. How hairy did it get out there?
It got really hairy. And that was part of, I knew it would be ahead of time. And part of my, you know, my paradigm or philosophy was, okay, we got to wait it out, you know, and only paddle when we have decent windows, you know, because I'm very safety conscious. It's funny that a lot of people think that people like me are adrenaline junkies. Well, that's not true.
You wouldn't be here at this age.
Exactly. Wouldn't be here. And those that aren't here, you know, adrenaline junkies. No, I'm extremely safe. And you know, and they say, well, you're not safe. You're going to the Arctic. Well, I'm going to the Arctic, but I'm not taking unnecessary risks. Every day and every hour, I'm measuring the most prudent, you know, navigation and what we do and when we go. And, you know, there was a lot of strife amongst team members because I, you know, sometimes when I would insist, no, we can't go. This is too rough. We're going to be here another day. And we'd be in the tent for 5 days sometimes. And maybe there'd be a couple hours that day that looked good. And some team members would say, hey, let's go. No, because we've got bad weather can, you know, predicted in the next 5 hours, and we're going to be out in the middle of nowhere. So no, we're not going.
So the long, and, you sat places for 5 days.
Yeah. Yeah. In our tent and on multiple occasions, and sometimes just 1 or 2 days. But, you know, that was my plan all along, was we're only going to paddle when conditions are right and safe. So the waves got huge, and we would have these giant, you know, 10-foot breakers hitting the shore where we were camping. And they got up to 25 feet around the bend at the end at Cape Bathurst, which is the western boundary of the Northwest Passage. I mean, in the middle of our paddling day that we had to avoid, there were some extremely dangerous wind and waves. A lot of people think, oh, you had a tailwind, that'll help you go faster. No, tailwinds are actually harder to paddle than a headwind, because your boat is teetering on top of a wave that's coming behind you, and your rudder's out of the water, and the rudder acts as a stabilizing force. And all of a sudden you're unstable.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're going into a wave that's coming at you, it's a lot more stable. Side waves aren't so bad, but a tailwind is not your friend.
So those 25-foot waves were deemed, you know, a paddling day for you, or was that?
Not at all.
Not at all.
We didn't expect those. Oh, we took off that morning. This was the last day we had to inside the passage. Now, we had 3 more days outside the passage we had to paddle, just like it took us 2 weeks to get to the start of the race, the start of the expedition. You know, we started paddling 70 miles before the start of the passage. So those 83 days are only 83 days officially. We actually were out there kayaking about 105 days. So because we had to paddle to the start and away from the finish. So this last day of paddling along the Franklin Hills, the Smoking Hills, to Cape Bathurst, it was rough conditions, but it was a side wind. So we could handle it, and we actually made really fast time. But then when it came to crossing around Cape Bathurst, we hit this shoal, and the shoal met with these huge winds that were coming in and created these giant waves that we had to go around. Two of our team members, one of the boats, almost got slammed by them because they were inside this little wave pattern. But luckily, they were able to turn into it and pull out of it. And shoot, they really showed their skill that day. They did a good job, because there was no way we could have rescued them. And they ended up having to turn straight into these giant waves and fly over them. And they're slammed down the other side, but they eventually made it to the safe area where we were waiting for them.
This is, the longer I talk, the crazier this gets, Wes. I mean, this is unbelievable. Just the fact that you could look at this and say, yeah, we can do this. And I mean, what did y'all do when you're sitting in the same tent together for 5 days? That had to be extremely difficult. Especially because it's not like a nice day. The reason you're sitting there is because the weather's bad.
Because you can't hang around outside. Exactly. So what we did then was we read our Kindles. We each brought, you know, well, three of us brought some books. Jeff, he's a contractor, building contractor. He would draw schematics of buildings and things. He would work on that.
He would work.
we napped a lot. We took a lot of naps. We looked forward to the next meal. And we had these crossword puzzles we did as a group. Now, and then also we'd play trivia games. And in one cabin, we were locked down in this one hunting cabin for about a week. And Mark Agnew came up with this idea of a talent show. And so he wanted us to each write and perform a song, which we spent a couple of days doing. I did a poem, and Mark won. He did this amazing song that he sang with a chorus and everything about our expedition. And the other two people, Jeff and Eileen, made poems as well. And so it was, you know, we were bored to death, but we, you know, we did these things. We wrote in our journals. We did videos.
Did you have any sort of communication with anyone?
Yeah, we had a sat phone, but we limited that because we didn't have a power. So we could text, which didn't eat up too much power, but we still limited that because we had a wind generator for power, but it was persnickety. And then we also had bricks, charger bricks that we would use. But other than that, we couldn't recharge anything. So we were very careful about, you know, using our outside communication for, you know, hopefully only necessary things like wind, weather, conditions, stuff like that.
You resupplied a few times.
Once.
Once. Only once.
Yeah.
Was that in Cambridge Bay?
Yeah, the town of Cambridge Bay. We mailed a bunch of our food and gear there ahead of time that was waiting for us. Unfortunately, the guy we mailed it to ate a lot of it.
Are you kidding me?
No, we were kind of shocked at that. It's like, why are these boxes open and where's our food? I don't know. Okay. And this is just a guy we found on Facebook, which I guess was a lesson to us. So we had to buy more food there. Like, there's a grocery store and we stayed in a hotel. We were in the lap of luxury while we were in Cambridge Bay. But it's on the outskirts of the world, that's for sure. But it had some wonderful modern amenities, you know, and the hotel we stayed in was absolutely wonderful and perfect, with clean sheets and heating and laundry. And so it was pretty great.
Did you tell anybody about it? What did they think?
Oh, small town. Everybody knew about us. Okay. Yeah, they knew we were there and they all wanted to talk about it. And they thought, a lot of people thought we were crazy. A lot of people thought this was really great. We got a lot of support. Mainly we got a lot of support, so that was neat. They wanted to know what we saw and everybody wanted to know if we were fishing. Y'all fishing? No, we're not fishing. Are you hunting? No, we're not. and we were doing something that no one had done. So we were a point of interest, that's for sure. But we regeared there and we got, you know, our food together. We spent a few days. Mainly we got there. We ended up there a little bit longer because the weather was bad. And then finally we got a good weather window and we left, but then the weather got bad that same day and we only made 7 miles and ended up going back to town and staying another night. And so that's when the weather really started to change. But that was our only resupply point right there.
The amount of setbacks and the amount of, like, so you went 7 miles and had to come back. I mean, that's just, there's so much that would really start to deplete the endurance and the morale of a team, I can imagine. I mean, it's just, it gets wilder and wilder the longer I listen. The 83 days, I thought you were out there the whole time, 83, but 105 total paddling. That's not a insignificant difference.
No. That's... 2 weeks just to get to the start through that ice. We made several attempts and had to keep going back because we'd go out into Baffin Bay and try to make it around the drift ice and have to get turned around. And we'd turn around and paddle all the way back to the hunting cabin where we were staying and stay another night. And the other thing was fog. People don't realize the Arctic, I mean, the fog is as thick as soup up there. When it gets foggy, you can't see 20 yards ahead of you. So how do you plan your route through these ice flows with this thick fog? That was a huge hindrance, you know, just getting those 2 weeks to the start.
Good gracious, man. So how did this compare to your plan, the 83 days on, the 105 days total?
We nailed it. Yeah, I expected 90 to 120 days, and we nailed it exactly.
Wow. Great plan. Yeah,
there was, you know, this is kind of weird, but, you know, I've had some readjustment issues coming back to the world. And one of them, one thing that I know this may sound a little overconfident, but I'm really good at doing these things. And I think I put a lot of planning into it. I'm not good at much anything else. I'm not financially successful. I'm not the best husband or father. I'm not the best friend. But I'm good at this. And part of the reason is I do a lot of planning ahead of time. I learn from people who have done similar things. I learn from people who live there, like Roald Amundsen learned from people up there. That's how he made it to the South Pole. And I think I'm really good at that. I'm not so cocky that I think I know everything about what's going on up there. So I try to adapt. Well, the planning I did for the Northwest Passage, I looked at all the rowing rigs and the kayaking that tried this, and I found out what wouldn't work. And you know, so I was confident in the kayaks we took and that these were the best crafts, vehicles, if you may, for this specific journey. And then the food, same thing. We knew exactly how many calories you would need to sustain ourselves, and the fuel and the weather conditions and the ice. And I knew that we'd have to lay over. And I planned on that. And it, sure, it's depressing to be in the tent for 5 days, but it's just part of the process. And I had to remind the team and myself several times when we were 3 or 4 days in a tent that, look, when, you know, Sir Edmund Hillary first climbed Everest, there were weeks sitting in tents sometimes waiting for the conditions to come up right. It took months to set up the base stations and the camp one, camp two, camp four, you know, all the way up. It took months up and down. And they'd be hammered in their tent with snow, you know, for weeks at a time. This was, when you're taking on an expedition such as the Northwest Passage, it's not going to be done fast. And you got to be patient. in order to make progress. And sometimes you have to sit on your ass for a while, but if you keep that goal in mind, you know, I think you'll succeed. And I think I've, you know, that's my one, well, one thing I'm good at.
Wow. No, that's some, serious transparency. Do you think doing these makes you better or worse at normal life in dealing with, you know, the responsibilities of being a husband, a dad, and a friend?
Worse. Yeah. I'm less tolerant of people whining about how bad they have it here. You know, if their latte's not made right, you know, less tolerant about people saying, you know, climate change is a hoax. People that take friendships for granted, things like that. You know, I feel kind of rudderless sometimes out here because I don't have this goal of making the end of a passage, you know, and then it can make things a little more difficult.
The more epic the adventure, the more serious the post-adventure backlash is what I see a lot, you know, and it's makes the readjustment that much harder.
There's this gal with the Paddler magazine. Her name's Katie, K-A-Y-D-I. She's a journalist. She did an interview with me a while back, and she sent me some things on this. We've talked about it. And there's some other explorers out there. I'm a member of the Explorers Club, and we've talked about this issue a lot and how to compact it and deal with it. You know, drinking helps a lot. If I could drink 24 hours a day, I think that would be a fix. Unfortunately, that's a really, really bad idea. And it's ultimately ineffectual. So drinking, yeah, don't, you know, you can't drink intravenously. So you got to figure out other ways. And so I think, you know, hair of the dog is the best answer. I think planning for the next expedition. And I'll be racing in the Texas Water Safari again this year. I've done it every year for the past, I don't know, 30 years or so. So I'll get out on the river and I'll spend hours out on the river kayaking. And that'll help band-aid me until my next expedition.
Well, man, it's the other side of it, you know, that is part, well, kind of like sitting in a tent for a week. It is, seems like part of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's, I think that's unavoidable.
That's well put. And it is unavoidable for those of us who feel more comfortable out there than in here. So that's just, you know, and to that end, our loved ones are patient with us. Our not so loved ones aren't patient with us. You know, my wife is incredibly tolerant. My sisters are amazing. My mom and dad are the best. And I have my friends, you know, like Jeff and close friends around me that are just wonderful. I think that's the best salve for this kind of situation.
Well, I've got one last question that maybe could cheer us up and end on a good note is, what's the funniest thing that happened out there?
Oh, gosh. There were several, actually. And we did have some good laughs out there, some really good laughs. You know, there was plenty of drama, but there were some really great laughs. And one of which I think was funniest was we had made it through Bellot Strait, which was a very horrendous day that almost killed us again. There's always deaths. There's a lot of death up there, potential death. And we made it through Bellot Strait, which I think we're the first to kayak through Bellot Strait, if anybody wants to look that up. And it's a 18 to 20 mile strait between Prince Regent Inlet and Lancaster Strait. Not Lancaster Strait, but Peel Sound, I think. It's only about a mile wide.
So do I see this is right? The northernmost point of the Americas?
That's it. Yeah.
Well, what's beyond that? Because there's land on the north of that.
Islands. This is contiguous.
Oh, got it. Got it.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so, yeah, and it's very narrow, and the tides rush through there at 9 knots. I mean, back and forth, east and west, and it brings with this very fast rushing ice. So, yeah, that almost killed us. So we got through there. And we're camping out at the other end at Peel Sound, and we're worn out and we're tired. And man, I tell you what, it wasn't dark then, but in the middle of our sleep, we couldn't say in the middle of the night, Jeff and I woke up because we heard our camp stuff, our cook stuff being messed with. It was about 20, 30 yards from the tent. We had to set up around these giant boulders. We left our cook stuff over there. And something was tinkling around with them. So we stuck our head out. Jeff stuck his head out first. And there was a bear messing with our camp stove and cook gear. So Jeff, by then we got kind of used to these polar bears. And Jeff just yells, "Hey, get! You get!" And that bear turned. He'd been, and his eyes got big, and he was like Pooh getting his hand caught in the cookie jar. He's like, "Oops, I didn't see you guys there." And he, "Oh my God!" And he turns around, and starts running, and we jump out and kind of chase him off. But it was such a funny look on this polar bear. You know, it's like, "Oops, oh no, I got caught."
Like so a
we
kid.
All had a good laugh out of that. Well, Eileen and Mark got a laugh out of Jeff telling them, "You get." Get out of here, you know, just yelling at him like a dog in the trash can. And that's how he responded. So that was a particularly funny moment.
It's obviously a pretty hardcore adventure when the funniest moment is you chasing a polar bear away. You know what I mean? When that's the funniest thing that happened and everything else is more hardcore, you know that this was a truly massively badass expedition.
It was the bar for humor was definitely skewed quite a bit.
Oh, that's okay with me. Gosh, man, Wes, I know that there's like books worth of information probably from this one experience, the 105 days and just everything that went in, and processing it's going to take years and in different ways and different facets. Is there anything else that just you feel like you need to share about it before we get off?
Well, I urge people to do these things because I really don't feel like I'm any different than most people. I'm a 61-year-old guy. In 2 months, I'll be 62. You know, if you have a desire to do something like this, do your homework. Learn how to paddle. Research it. Get out and see the world. I don't think it takes a superhuman. It just takes some dedication and some perseverance. And if I can be of any help to anybody who wants to do these things, get a hold of me. You can find me through westhanson.com, and I'm happy to help out anybody that wants to go where I've been, down the Amazon River, the Volga River, or in the Northwest Passage. I'll do everything I can to help anybody out.
Well, Wes, thank you so much for being on and telling this story. I'm going to have to keep myself from asking more, and I'll encourage folks to listen to some other things, read some of the articles, and just this is a massive, massive expedition.
Thank you. Hopefully the documentary will be out in a year or so, and the book will be the same. So I'm working on the book now.
That's its own. From everyone we talk to that releases a book, a book is sometimes harder than the adventure. So
I agree.
First of all, thank you so much for listening. It means the world to us that you choose to listen to this show. If you'd like to help us further, you can leave a review on iTunes, share us with your friends, your family. It goes a long way to grow in the show. You can also support us financially through patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. Link is in the show notes. And also, if you have an idea of who could be a good guest for the show, we're always looking for people to tell their story about the outdoors or adventure. So if you know someone, please reach out. Email us at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. And until then, get out there and have some fun.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.